This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On Friday, June 28th, an American student named Andrew Pachter was killed in Egypt amidst political protests in Alexandria. He was a 21-year-old student at Kenyon College. That night, Duke University pulled their students out of Cairo. At around 2 or 3 in the morning, students left for a town called Sharm el-Sheikh, 300 miles outside of Cairo. Julia Janko, Stephen Arena, and Nellie Gillespie are students in the program. James Spencer is the site coordinator for a program called Duke Engage in Cairo. Duke Engage is a program that arranges community service opportunities for Duke students here and abroad. And I want to welcome all of you to the program. Nice to have you in the State of Things.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
James, tell us a little bit about first of all, what was going on, because June 30th, I mean, people knew that there were protests aimed at then-President Mohamed Morsi. Tell us about the buildup to those protests while you were there.
Well, it was quite strange because it all started about 2 months before the students ever got there, back in March. And there were, from what I've heard, it was just 5 activists sitting in a cafe, and they decided to start a petition where they would get as many signatures as they could to show their dissatisfaction with the Brotherhood government. And they amassed over 20 million. And once that was known and people saw how much support was against the Brotherhood, they decided to hold this protest on June 30th. And we saw it coming from about a month away, and we had to make contingency plans just for that day. And you could see people in the streets signing petitions and with clipboards and, you know, asking questions. And, yeah, it was ubiquitous. It was everywhere.
Yeah. When did you all arrive?
We arrived in early June. I had been there for the past year, though, and I've probably logged around nearly 3 years in Cairo. So I had been there prior to their arrival, but the students came in early June.
And you would be there now if you hadn't evacuated. Tell us how long you would have stayed.
I would have personally been there until mid-August, and the students would have been there until, I think, about August 4th. So the program was cut short, pretty much cut in half. We had to leave 1 month in a two-month program.
Well, let's find out a little bit about what you all were doing there, and then we'll hear more about your experience in those last days before you came out. Julia, tell us about your project. What were you doing there?
So we were working with a couple of different NGOs. So during the day, about half the group was with an NGO that was just outside of Cairo called Ana al-Masri, and we were working with street children during the day. We taught English, art, sports classes, and we're working with them. And then at night, we had, on alternating days, we either took Arabic classes or we were teaching English. We were teaching to adults in the community. We were teaching English classes at night. So we had a couple of different partner NGOs that we had.
Stephen, how about you?
I did just about the same thing. I went to al-Masri. I worked with the preschool children. And, we also taught English to some people who are usually around in their 20s or 30s at night, and also took Arabic class.
And Nellie, tell me what you were doing.
So I was actually one of the people working at Al-Qiyan. And the three other people I was with, we did a variety of things for the organization. We spent some time working actually with the kids who were suffered from a variety of different disabilities. Sometimes we helped them with art class, sometimes just their regular schoolwork. And then the other times we were working on writing grant letters or articles in English for the organization, as well as translating their and editing their English version of their website.
That's interesting to think that being able to write grants in English is going to be a very important part of what an NGO does in any country, I guess. Huh?
Yes.
James, let's talk about the situation there, because to some extent, I mean, obviously things had settled down from the initial protests that led to the elections that brought Mohamed Morsi to power as president, first free elections, truly democratic elections in decades. What was your understanding of the situation? And as you said, you had been there for years. So when you prepare the site, what's your understanding in the months leading up to this of kind of how things were in terms of stability in Cairo?
Well, stability, you know, it's always a relative thing in Cairo. It's difficult to tell when things will erupt, and you know, small sparks can start big fires. And I guess with the lead up, nobody really expected it to be much more than just a big peaceful demonstration. And I think a lot of analysts were kind of blindsided by the military stepping in just 48 hours after the outpouring of anti-Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations. Now, given that the demonstrations were remarkably large, I think CNN and a lot of other news outlets confirmed that the numbers were larger than the original revolution back in 2011. Right. So a substantial amount of people.
And this begins, you left on the 28th, and we'll talk about that, but you could see the buildup. People were beginning to gather, and these demonstrations had, in effect, begun before the June 30th, the actual scheduled date, right?
Yeah, and a lot of different cities, too, not just in Cairo. And I think compounding all of that, something I experienced on a daily basis, and I know the students did also, is there would always be rolling blackouts throughout Cairo, more so than in any summer past. And also, which was even worse, was that there were very, very bad fuel shortages. And we'd be driving to these different locations, the orphanage and to the Center for Children with Disabilities, and traffic would be at a standstill throughout the entire city for an entire week leading up to the demonstrations. So we definitely got a good taste of the frustration that Egyptians had to deal with. I think that really led to people coming out to the streets.
But that was sort of some of the ongoing troubles, as you suggest, and not directly related to the demonstrations themselves. So that was something that you would have experienced had there not been demonstrations, right?
There was a piece in the New York Times that was questioning that. There were these fuel shortages had never occurred to this extent in Cairo, and it was a little bit curious, some people would say, that they occurred a week before this huge demonstration was planned. And the rolling blackouts, yes, those would happen regardless of whether or not there were demonstrations. But it was there were a lot of things leading up to it that were stoking the fire, so everything was very combustible come June 30th.
Well, let me ask all of you, and I'll start with you, Julia. What was your sense of what you were getting into? Julia?
I think we all kind of knew in advance that we were going to need to be careful when we got to Cairo. But I think one of the coolest things was when we got there, everything, at least in the beginning and for those first few weeks, was very calm. We felt completely safe for the most part. Sometimes at night we felt the need to, we definitely needed to be in groups and everything. Sometimes things like taking the metro, transferring near Tahrir Square, things like that. But we all felt incredibly safe in the city, so it was just an interesting experience because we went in being very cautious. Obviously, our family and friends and everyone at home were pretty worried, but I definitely felt very safe for the most part, and I think it wasn't until, kind of like Jack said, in the weeks leading up to the protests that you could see that things were coming, that, you know, the storm was coming, that people were getting very anxious. You could see the lines for the gas, talking to people. They were talking about, you know, the protests coming, that they wanted to gather. When you went on the metros, there were crowds. There were people handing out flyers, people, you know, trying to gather signatures for petitions. So we could see that things were coming, but it wasn't until probably those 2 days before we left that we kind of needed to stay in our apartment that people were gathering in massive crowds. So we could see it was coming, and we're starting to anticipate it. But in the first few weeks that we were there, I think for the most part we all felt extremely safe. So,
well, Stephen, how did you feel as you started to notice these things changing?
Yeah, well, when I first got there, I heard about the demonstrations that were going to happen on June 30th, and I initially just kind of brushed it off as just peaceful demonstrations. But as we got closer and closer, we started hearing rumors from different people. We got mixed opinions. Some people thought it was going to be very big. Some people thought it was just going to be, just a few protests or demonstrations that were, pretty mundane. But it wasn't until, as Julia said, a few days before June 30th, about the weekend before, that we could hear people, going to Tahrir. And that's when things started to get appear serious.
Nellie, let me ask you about the people you were working with. Were they trying to engage you in conversations, political conversations, telling you what they thought and then asking you your opinion? How did that go?
So at Alkeon, I didn't have any political conversations with my coworkers, but at Al-Risala, my students were very, very eager to talk about politics, even though that was one of the no-nos. We weren't supposed to do that. And they would tell me that, oh, they're planning on going to the protests, or no, they're planning to stay in. And actually, one of our tour guides towards the beginning of the trip, who was involved with the opposition movement, actually invited us to come protest on the 30th, but that didn't happen.
James, how about you? Were you because I, you know, people might try to engage you in conversations, and on the one hand, tell you what they think, but also try to get from you how you're seeing this, and if not you, how Americans see this, how Americans are viewing this, and what kind of information they're getting. Were you getting those kind of conversations?
Oh yeah, absolutely. On a daily basis, taxi drivers, grocers, anybody I met on the street or interacted with, it was on everybody's lips. And it is very polarized. You know, you have some people who have been born and raised in Muslim Brotherhood families or communities where they went to Muslim Brotherhood schools, they went to Muslim Brotherhood summer camps, and, you know, they feel very strongly about their organization. And then there are other groups that feel very marginalized, among them the Coptic Christians, the liberal Muslims, and the ultra-conservative Muslims. They were marginalized also. So, yeah, it just depends on who you talk to. You'd hear two completely different versions of events.
Well, I'm wondering how what kind of effect that had on all of you. And I'll start with you, Julia. I'm assuming you knew something about what had happened in Tahrir Square initially to bring all this on and the Arab Spring. You got coverage. Maybe you were getting it here in the United States. And now you're over there talking to people, albeit for a month. How has that changed your understanding of the situation there?
I think it's been really interesting for us because it's so different to have an inside perspective and to see, kind of like Jack was saying, to kind of be there and see, especially as we got closer to the protests, the fuel shortages, the power outages, to see even amongst my students, all the students that I was working with at night in my night classes were all unemployed. They were all students, had just graduated, had degrees, and couldn't find a job. So I think it was interesting for me because when you're watching it on TV ahead of time, you know that people are protesting, that they want change, you know, under Mubarak's regime, the same thing. But it was a really different experience to talk to people who say, I'm unemployed, you know, these are the struggles I face on a daily basis. I have to wait in 3 hours worth of lines to get gas. You kind of see those impacts firsthand. So that was a really different experience and kind of makes it a lot more personal when you can see how badly the change is needed, I guess.
So you get a much closer and a much more visceral view. And Stephen, I'm wondering, you know, what James said about the multiplicity of views, that it's not even two or three different views, but various groups who have different kinds of complaints. What does that do to your understanding? If you look back over the coverage, do you think, well, maybe I wasn't getting the whole story here. I understood it as a problem of democracy and not democracy, and now it turns out it may be more than that. And I'm just wondering how, you know, if your understanding changed or what kind of thoughts were going through your mind as you're hearing all these different views.
Like I said, like you were talking about before, in times of the revolution, it just seemed like everyone, you know, they wanted democracy, and then they got it, and that was mission accomplished. But it's not, that's not the only thing they needed. You know, they still weren't getting, they had the gasoline shortages, they had power outages. So there were still a lot of problems that the country was facing that we weren't really getting. We also weren't really seeing the political divide that existed. There were a lot of people who were very pro-Morsi, a lot of people who were very anti-Morsi. And it wasn't until, you know, all these protests erupted that we really got a world view of the political divide.
How complicated it is. Nally, let's talk about now you're leaving Cairo. When did you first get the word that you might not be staying there, and what did you do?
So immediately as we planned our trip to Sharm el-Sheikh, there was always the possibility that we would have to leave Cairo. My professor at first put it, there's a 99.9% chance that we aren't leaving, but as June 30th started getting closer and closer, I think in the back of all of our minds, we started to realize that it was a real possibility that once we went to Sharm el-Sheikh, which was the resort town, we were for a week.
And excuse me, but that was that a part of the trip anyway? That was already scheduled, or was that scheduled because you needed a place to go and think this through?
So normally Duke Engage schedules some sort of fun trip for maybe a few days. So my professor just scheduled our fun trip for the June 30th time. So it wasn't exactly planned just for the protest, but it was placed conveniently for there. So
let me put this to Julia. When you finally realized that you were going to have to leave, I mean, what were your feelings at the time when you realized you got to go?
We were so upset. We could kind of tell. We got to Sharm. Things were getting bad. Things were getting worse. Once the military had stepped in, we kind of started to realize that there were probably very few realistic situations that would allow us to get back to Cairo, because it was looking more and more like the situation just wasn't going to get to a point that it was stable enough for us to return. So we could kind of tell that things weren't looking so good, but we kept pushing it back. Our professor kept trying to give us a little more time to talk to Duke Engage, give the situation a little more time to work out.
The State Department had already the State Department had issued an advisory for Americans, so there's plenty of official warning. Yeah.
Exactly. So we knew that things weren't looking so good, but I don't think it was until we actually received word and they said you're going home that kind of reality hit that we weren't actually going back. I think we all from the beginning just expected to go back and pick right up where we left off. So it was a really hard adjustment for us to make, even if we kind of expected it.
Yeah, let me stay with you, Julia, and then go around the table to ask what you took away from this experience. Julia?
So many things. I think one of the greatest things we learned was how to work with so many different types of people. It was a challenge every day to work with the kids and have a language barrier. They were exhausting and energetic and a challenge every single day, but I think each day that also taught us something new, and we kept going back and we kept working with it. And it was the same with teaching our classes at night. There was always challenges. There were power outages. We took a day trip one day to Alexandria, and it took us 6 hours to get there because we were stuck in a protest. And I think if there's anything we learned in Cairo, it's that we had to learn how to go with it and take every day as it was and take all the challenges that we faced, take it day by day and just enjoy it while we could.
Stephen?
And we all grew to love the city so much.
No.
So.
Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, there were obviously a few skills we learned, like, language skills, and we got some great experiences out of it. But really the biggest thing I think we received was just a different perspective. You know, after seeing a totally different culture and a totally different way of living, you come back to America and things aren't quite the same. You see things totally differently. You know, after going through sitting in hours of traffic, you're thankful for, streetlights. And you look at things totally differently.
Nellie?
So I would say it's definitely the people that made the trip so worth it. Not just the group I was with, but the Egyptian people. The incredible amount of welcoming we received, as well as the optimism I heard in people's voices, despite everything that was going wrong, whether it was my friend in Alexandria, who was so happy for me to be in Egypt, even though he was so disillusioned with his government, or one of my friends in Cairo, who is actually Christian and experienced persecution because of his religious beliefs, was also still so happy and ready to talk to us and listen to our stories and share their own stories.
James Spencer, are you going to be? Are you going to continue as site coordinator in Cairo?
Well, that depends if the program is reinstated next summer.
Right.
We still don't know yet. There's no word on it. But if given the opportunity, I would definitely consider it. Cairo is a wonderful city, and I hope that everybody over there can get through this time, because there's a lot of violence raging through the streets. And
James, thanks so much. Thank all of you. James Spencer, site coordinator for Duke Engage in Cairo, Julia Janko, Stephen Arena, and Nellie Gillespie, students at Duke University. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There's more of the State of Things ahead. Stay tuned.